The 2016 Arizona legislative session gets underway next Monday with Governor Doug Ducey's State of the State address. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk with a couple of lawmakers about their expectations for the session, what issues will be at the forefront, will there be any bipartisanship, and how long will it last? Also, the release of the new film, The Big Short, has conjured up some rough memories for Valley residents who were involved in the housing industry in the worst times of the Great Recession. How and why was the Phoenix area hit so hard, and what lessons were learned? We'll talk with a panel of experts about that. Plus, the Phoenix Suns are in the midst of one of the worst runs in franchise history, and team owner Robert Sarver is putting some of the blame on, quote, millennial culture. I'll ask ESPN's Amin El-Hassan what that means. And is the Western still a popular and relevant genre in fiction? Valley attorney and author Gary Stewart thinks so. I'll talk with him. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the release of the new film The Big Short has conjured up some memories for Valley residents who were involved in the housing industry in the worst times of the Great Recession. How and why was the Phoenix area hit so hard, and what lessons were learned? We'll talk with a panel of experts about that. Plus, the Phoenix Suns are in the midst of one of the worst runs in franchise history, and team owner Robert Sarver is putting some of the blame on, quote, millennial culture. I'll ask ESPN's Amin El-Hassan what that means. And I'll talk with novelist Tim Johnston about his literary thriller Descent, set in the Rocky Mountains. We start today's program by getting ready for the beginning of the 2016 legislative session next Monday. The 2015 session was very short and involved a lot of cooperation between Republican legislative leaders and Governor Doug Ducey. Will we see more of the same in 2016? With me to talk about that is Senate President Andy Biggs. President Biggs, first of all, before we get to some specific issues, you are definitely someone who seems to like efficient sessions of the legislature. That was certainly the case last year. Are you looking for something similar this time around?
Well, I would say this is most likely to be a little bit longer than last time, but probably shorter than most sessions.
What are your personal priorities for this session? I'm sure that the caucus has certain things in mind. Are there certain things that you want to prioritize?
I think there's two goals. Number one, we want to get something with regard to public safety pension reform. Senator Lesko has been working on that, and I believe we should have something ready to go and get out of this session. So that's very important to do because we have to stabilize our pensions, at least one pension. The second would be is to produce a structurally balanced budget, which would we anticipate coming out of 2016, fiscal year 2016, structurally balanced, and the balance that we produce for fiscal year 2017, I think, should be structurally balanced and not dig us back into a hole.
I say facetiously, you don't seem to have unattainable goals there. And pension reform has been such a huge issue. Are there certain things about what you've discussed with Debbie Lesko that seems like it's really hitting the good points, that seems like it'll make sense?
Yeah, you know, we realize that we have to be in line with federal law and state law, and you can't jeopardize or impair contracts that are in place with current pensioners and those who are relying on certain levels of pension. But at the same time, we have to stabilize the pensions in order that we can fulfill those promises as a state. For instance, the one that we're really working on now is the public safety pension, which is considered one of the probably ranked sixth or seventh worst government-funded pension fund in the country. And we think that with the work that she's done and the people on both sides that have, or all, I should say there's more than both sides, but all sides that have come in and worked, we think that this will stabilize and then actually be fully funded at least within the next 20 years, which is actually a generation, which is a good thing.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Just a couple of more minutes left with Senate President Andy Biggs as a legislative session for 2016, just a few days away. President Biggs, you know, education funding, always a big issue. Voters are going to have a chance to decide on the state land trust plan, which is obviously more complicated than that, but that was initially proposed by the governor. K-12, university funding. What do you see as far as 2016?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm excited that we were able to get the lawsuit settled. There were a lot of efforts on people on all sides, from the plaintiffs, from the defendants, from the governor's office. You know, a lot of people got into that and really were successful in doing that. Now, the next thing, of course, is we have to get the voters. We have to encourage the voters and try to persuade them that the cause is just and that $3.5 billion over 10 years to K-12 education is, without raising taxes, is a worthwhile and valid goal. And so that's one of the main things with regard to K-12 funding that we need to do first off. And then when you get beyond that, I think that you're going to need to – we will need to look at transparency reform. I think the entire K-12 funding formulas are really so convoluted that we need to try to see if we can get that cleared up, and that's a big monumental task as well. But the first goal will be to get that Prop 123 passed, and then you also asked about university funding, mm-hmm. and you know, we're just so you know, the requests, whether it's from universities or from any other subdivision of the state and even folks who aren't part of the state government, the requests to spend exceed that when I talked about the cash in the wallet, our cash balance exceeds that by about twofold. So it's a balancing and priority act that we'll be doing.
And one final question for you. Department of Child Safety has received a lot of additional funding over the past couple of years. A lot of lawmakers don't believe enough improvement has taken place, but there are calls for even more money for DCS. Where do you see that going? I presume people are looking at this with a pretty skeptical eye, and yet they're also very worried about these kids.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, we've seen this agency go from, in the last 3 years or so, from a $380 million a year agency to, it's knocking on the door of $1 billion a year, and what we see is a bigger backlog, more kids being taken and removed out of homes, and yet the increase in spending is at least twofold, and yet the complaints coming into the hotline have only increased by 20%, and yet we're having all these additional problems which you've identified. So I think what you see here is we want this cleaned up, and so we want there needs to be some policy. We put money in specifically to do intervention programs. We're not seeing that take place the way we want to. We put money in and $29 million so we could do privatization of the backlog, to eliminate the backlog and release the pressure on the rest of the caseworkers to do the active cases today. They didn't privatize. So there's a lot of concern out there, and this is going to be looked at with a lot of scrutiny, and it has been over the last year, and it's not going to go away. We're going to continue to push to try to get some reforms done in this area.
State Senate President Andy Biggs helping us preview the beginning of the legislative session, which kicks off next Monday. President Biggs, thanks.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, and with me for a few minutes with another perspective on the 2016 session is Assistant Senate Minority Leader Steve Farley. Senator Farley, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Yeah, always good to have you on. So, in general, I want to get your take on what you expect to go. In the 2015 session was quite short, and for a lot of people, they thought it was unfairly short. What are your thoughts about that, and do you expect it to be a short session this time around also?
Well, yeah, and in fact, the fact that they rushed through the budget in 3 days in the middle of March, an unprecedentedly early time, with minimal public input, really sort of bit us in the rear end afterwards. If we had had more time to actually look at that budget, we would have known, in fact, a month later in April, that our revenue picture looked much better. We would not have had to make the draconian cuts that ended up being made in that budget. This year, hopefully, since we're sitting on over $1 billion surplus, if you count the rainy day fund, there won't be as many battles about cutting because stuff has been cut consistently. So I don't think that's going to hold it up. But I think what could hold up the session is if Governor Ducey decides to carry through on his promises to completely eliminate the state income tax, mm-hmm. that would represent 40% of our overall revenues. And at the same time, it would eliminate all the income tax credits that a lot of key Republican leaders really love, such as the private school tuition tax credits that Majority Leader Yarbrough loves. If that happens, there could be battles amongst the Republicans about what to do about that. not to mention those of us who are Democrats thinking that eliminating a tax that actually would be replaced by a sales tax on groceries or a higher sales tax for the middle class and the poor, while giving a huge bailout to the rich, is probably not a good idea.
Yes, Steve, I want to come back to that, eliminating the income tax thing, because obviously Governor Ducey has advocated for that. It sounds like he has wanted to do that in pieces. So regardless of whether that actually happens, certainly tax cuts are going to be on the docket. And as you mentioned, this idea that the state has a surplus now, that doesn't necessarily seem to jive with what a lot of Republican lawmakers are looking at. They seem to say, well, what happens with the next downturn? We want to make sure this money is available. Is this, again, a fight of investment versus people saying, well, we need to prepare for the next rainy day, whenever that might be?
Well, I think from the Republican side, it's been primarily we want to shrink government to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub, as Grover Norquist said famously a few years ago. I think what voters are going to ask is, if we have this much surplus sitting around the state, money much more than would have taken to settle the education lawsuit for K-12 in its entirety, why are you asking us to put the land trust at risk in Proposition 123 to pay for only 70% of what the court ordered you have to pay for our schools? So if they further take that surplus and put it into tax cuts that have been proven to do nothing for our economy at all, I think voters are going to say, what sort of shell game are you playing here? Because there are legitimate education expenses we need to keep doing. And even if Prop 123 passes, that's only $200 per pupil more than what we're paying now. And that's just enough to squeak us from 50th to 49th past North Dakota in state support for K-12 education. And we haven't funded textbooks or computers in 5 years. We haven't funded building maintenance in 5 years. There's currently 44% of our new teachers leave after 2 years. There is a teacher retention crisis, so we need money for teachers. All this stuff needs to happen. And the folks pushing 123 are saying, that's it. This is going to solve all of our crises. That's absolutely not true. And then there's the JTED programs, which are at risk of a death spiral if we don't get rid of the cuts that were instituted last year and if we don't do that as an emergency in January.
And Steve, President Biggs does not seem to be a big advocate for restoring a lot of the university funding. Do you think that'll come up again? Do you think there's any Republican support for pushing that through?
I think there is, because there was an agreement to have that at a $25 million more in spending than they ended up agreeing last year, and then they went back on that agreement, and the university is just simply asking for that. Universities really aren't asking for that much this year, considering $2.5 billion cut from their budgets over the last 5 years. And I think they would have a good chance of getting that, I would hope, because our universities are our original economic engines in this state. And if we're not talking about figuring out how to create jobs to make sure that we don't have another economic downturn, then we're not doing our constituents a good turn.
Certainly a lot of our listeners are fans of bipartisanship, and we didn't see a lot of that in the 2015 legislative session. Do you think there's going to be some of that in 2016?
Well, it was encouraging to hear the President Biggs talks about pension reform, because I really do think that is a major issue that we can come together on. I've been involved with some of those talks with Senator Lesko and the fire unions, the police unions, the public safety, the retirement system. I think we will come up with a consensus solution to be able to bail that out. We're going to need to move further, because our EORP retirement system is in even more trouble, and that involves judges and elected officials throughout the state. That's only funded, I think, at 38%, which you're supposed to be up at 90 to 100%. So we've got to deal with a lot more in our retirement crisis, but this is a great first step, and I think an important one that we could actually work together on. Additionally, child safety, I think we can work together on that as well. I made a motion that became a bipartisan vote in our JLBC meeting last month, in which we accepted as unfavorable the report that was being given by the Division of Child Safety. And the director of child safety, Greg McKay, didn't even show up to defend his terrible record as the head of that department. So I think he needs to be replaced, in my mind. I'm not sure we'll get bipartisan reports for that, because management has been one of the main problems with the Division of Child Safety, and why we have almost 20,000 kids removed removed from their homes here in Arizona right now. And so we've got to put the focus back on prevention and early intervention programs, because what we've seen in the skyrocketing abuse and neglect cases is what happens when you stop keeping kids safe in their homes in the first place with prevention programs. And that stuff has been cut consistently by the majority over here for years. And now, even though we're starting to put some money back in intervention and in things like child care subsidies we need to do more of, the Department of Child Safety has been taking that money and moving it into out-of-home care instead of prevention and early intervention. So they're in a cycle in which they continually get more kids in trouble. And they can't even tell us whether or not those kids are in imminent danger. That's one of the most shocking things that came out of that committee last week.
And there seems to be bipartisan.
We really got to change this thing.
And that does seem to have bipartisan concern there. Yeah. Assistant Senate Minority
Absolutely
Leader.
There is.
Yeah. Assistant Senate Minority Leader Steve Farley. Steve, sorry to cut you off. I need to go, but always appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll take a look at the film The Big Short and what memories it brings for folks in the Arizona real estate industry. And then later on this hour, what is wrong with the Phoenix Suns? We'll talk about all of that coming up.
KJZZ is supported by Litchfield Park's 24th Annual Native American Festival this weekend, starting daily at 10 a.m. with fine art cultural demonstrations, hoop dancers, and music. Festival details at litchfieldparkgathering.com.
This is Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Stay with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Taking a look at traffic in the Phoenix area in the West Valley in surprise, Cotton Lane is closed between Peoria and Cactus, and that's due to a sinkhole in the road. Around the state right now, light snow reported in Flagstaff, where it's 28 degrees. They've gotten 3 inches of snow so far today there. Cloudy skies, 38 in Prescott. It's sunny and 55 in Casa Grande. Scattered clouds in 55 down in Tucson. Partly sunny, 58 degrees right now in Yuma. Well, if your favorite car has been around the block a few too many times and you've decided to buy that shiny new one you've been wanting, you can turn your old car into a valuable donation for your favorite programs on KJZZ. Complete the easy form at cars.kjzz.org. It's partly cloudy here in Phoenix and 56 degrees at 11:23.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The new film, The Big Short, based on the book by Michael Lewis, takes us back in time to the beginning of the Great Recession and focuses on a few men who foresaw the collapse of the global economy and were able to take advantage of it financially, and then things got crazy. The real estate bubble burst, and the Valley was hit as hard as any other community in the country. With me to look back at what happened and whether lessons have been learned and things have changed are Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com, Michael Metz, Vice President of Mortgage Lending for Guaranteed Rate, and Catherine Rieger, real estate reporter for AZ Central and the Arizona Republic. Welcome to everybody.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Hello.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
Good morning.
John, I'm going to start with you first and Michael as well. I want to get your observations quickly about The Big Short. Did you feel like it portrayed the situation accurately? Not really giving a review in terms of stars, but in terms of accuracy. What do you think, John?
Well, from my point of view, I was in the trenches as selling, so it was nice to see. We knew there was crazy stuff going on, but to see what was going on in Wall Street, what were they thinking? So that was really nice to see that part of the story.
Yeah. Michael, what do you think?
Very accurate portrayal. Being in the mortgage business at that time, I went to see the movie with just recently with my 85-year-old father. And quite honestly, I was a little embarrassed in some of the portrayal, but I could not deny that it wasn't going on out there.
Catherine, what have you heard from folks about the film?
I have heard, yes, that very Australian. I have to be honest, I ain't seen it this weekend with my husband. Get pretty upset at these movies. When I saw The Inside Job, I was shaking with anger because of what was being done on Wall Street and how it was playing out here. But I am hearing accurate betrayal and upsetting, but also entertaining. And I think it's a good time to remind us of what we went through and the pain as we see some more efforts going on Wall Street with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac right now.
Michael, I want to talk about sort of the American dream, which is that, you know, people want to have a home.
Yes.
I recall, and I live in a very modest house, but I recall in 06, especially maybe 07 a bit, I'd go out to get the morning paper. Someone would drive by and say, I will give you cash for your house right now. Now, of course, I couldn't afford to move in any place nicer, so I stayed. But it was amazing that it got to that point, and then we came down from there. Was there a way to envision that something like this could have happened? Was the system messed up, or did some people just take it too far?
I think probably the latter. I mean, there's a little bit of responsibility blame that could go everywhere. But, you know, unfortunately, greed will prevail. And when that – when you have lenders willing to lend money, and again, as in the movie portrayed, as Wall Street wanted more product, it was out there. And, of course, we had the stated income loan where people did not have to document their income. You just tell me how much you're making. I'll loan you the money. And that, I think, was the real problem in the industry.
Well, that seems amazing to me, this idea that you'd be able to do that and not foresee that there would be an issue. Do people just always think things are going to get better?
I mean, for the most part, I think memories are very short. Greed prevails with it. And but right now, guess what just came out about 6 months ago? The stated income loan. It's back for purchases. And that book of business, that stated income pool, was securitized and sold on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. So it's back.
Catherine, jump in on that, would you?
Yes, and that concerns me as well, and I'm watching that. And, you know, and you go back and you look at, and we really started seeing this in 2004, people getting loans and more loan officers who weren't licensed because they weren't required at that point. And unfortunately, we had a lot of white-collar criminals doing these loans, and they were telling homeowners, you can afford this house, this is all you need to put down. And our society, we thought, if a lender is telling me that I can get this loan and Countrywide's going to back it, I must be able to afford it. So a lot of people like to blame the homeowners, but in many cases, these people thought, if this lender's going to back it, it must be okay. I must be able to afford it. And then these didn't know these subprime loans. And what really hit everybody on the back of the head was what Wall Street was doing with them and how they were bundling them together. That was the big, you know, surprise. And shock and what we went through. And I'm watching the loans now and again, watching what's happening, the efforts to privatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and with insiders there and take them from the government and what that could mean with the funneling of the loans there. So I think it's a good time for this film and to talk about these issues so we don't see any kind of repeat.
And it's an important issue. I want to come back to that. John, I want to get you into sort of the real estate aspect of this thing because it did seem like a lot of people thought they could be a realtor. Everything was perfect. And I wonder, did that mess up that part of the industry as well, this part that you didn't have quite the same expertise involved in that part of the industry?
A lot of it was that everybody thought they could be an investor.
Okay.
So you would go out to a house and show it, and while the time you're showing it to a client, two or three other groups would come through. Or the bad thing is you would walk into a house to show it to a client, and somebody's writing a contract on the kitchen counter already with their clients, or on the car hood as you pull up. It was nuts. It was totally nuts. The prices were going up from the first 6 months of 2005. The median home price was going up $10,000 a month. It was insane.
Yeah, Catherine?
Yes, it was. It was crazy. And the flood of real estate agents that got in the market who were not seasoned, they didn't have that experience, and most of them are long gone from the market, and the industry, I believe, is very happy about that. But yes, it was very scary to watch it. And, you know, the investors that started from out of state, and they were coming in on buses. There were groups coming in. They were buying the new homes and flipping them for profits by the time they were built. And then local people saw that and say, hey, you're making money in my market. And, hey, I can get these loans. I'm going to invest. I have a small business. And just got caught up in it. And I think it goes back to this greed. Everybody, you know, it's great to make money, but no one wants to be the last one in. And when the crashing was coming and it started Wall Street and trickled down, but it was really a very scary time. And the aftermath was still so painful for so many people. Our home prices still haven't recovered to, you know, peak levels.
John, did you want to jump in?
No, I'm just thinking about the peak level thing. We're years kind of jump to the conclusion. There's about 100,000 owner-occupied homes in the valley, in Maricopa County, that are still underwater. They were bought in 2005, 2006, 2007. They're still underwater. That's like one out of nine homes are still underwater. There's still reverberations that still have an effect on the market these 10 years later.
Yeah. Michael, how do you look at the industry right now? And I'm wondering because, you know, we're talking about all these horrible things and whatnot. And did that hurt the industry overall and the perception of it to a point where even that part of the industry is still recovering? Or
Do you agree with Catherine that this is the time for a movie like that, for example?
Oh, absolutely agree. Everything Catherine said, spot on with it. And yes, the industry, our industry, the mortgage industry at that time, was tainted. And many of the things it's portrayed in the movie, I have to admit, that's what was going on out there. But now, and what we had then was a very low barrier to entry to get in the mortgage industry and a very high return, unlimited on what you can make off of a borrower. So we had people taking advantage of people. Today, with the licensing effect, with the regulation, it could still happen with a bad apple, but for the most part, it's bringing integrity back to the industry. And that's good for the consumer with it. It's not
And a lot of the riskiest loans are gone. Mm.
There are some people, though, who are still frustrated by the fact that, at least as they perceive it, that people did not get punished in the sense that they should have in order to make that. I mean, do you agree with that?
I would agree with that, because if we would have had penalties in place back at that time that said, hey, if you lie on a mortgage application or you're a lender and you commit fraud, you're going into prison for 20 years hard time, I don't think we'd have had quite as much of it going on. But fraud, especially in Phoenix, was huge at the time. It was a wink and a nod. People, you know, as Catherine was saying, you'd go to the water cooler at work and your coworker said, I just made $20,000 flipping this house. Yeah. You say, hey, how do I do it? Call so-and-so, do it. And they'd say, hey, how much do you make? Well, we'll tell you. You put down you're making $200,000 a year, you'll have no problem with this. That stuff does not go on today, and it's good that it does not.
Yeah, Catherine, follow up on that.
Yes, I Mike, absolutely, and it's great to hear it and watching that really the bad players have been pushed out of the industry. And we have a very sophisticated industry here, and the veterans know and they watch. And I get calls if something's just a little odd on a deal or they see an odd trend, because the fraud and the cashback deals and the inflating the home prices were terrible. And I think there's still, and this movie brings over a resentment that from Wall Street, I think one player, and it's not Bernie Madoff because he wasn't directly part of this, went to prison, but that the people who took out the loans and maybe didn't understand, and not everybody's innocent, but people who lost that home to foreclosure or did everything right, but their home values crashed 50% around them, and maybe they lost their job in the recession or had their hours cut back and lost their home, are angry about that and still find that to be unfair because of the mechanics that were going on in New York and Wall Street that were playing out here and hurting us.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. That's Catherine Rieger, real estate reporter for AZ Central and the Arizona Republic. Also with me, Michael Metz, vice president of mortgage lending for Guaranteed Rate, and realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. We're talking about the film The Big Short and how it reminds us of the Valley's real estate collapse around 2008. John?
Yeah, so what was going on is they were making riskier and riskier loans. They were just a little risky, but then nothing bad happened because the prices went up. So then they make even more risky loans, and nothing bad happens because prices go up. So it went to the point at the end they were making tremendously riskier loans. Like, they had teaser rates, which is absolutely insane. Well, you qualified for the loan on the 1 or 2 year teaser rate. You don't have to qualify and show income that you could handle that loan after the teaser ended. So those were some of the first loans that once prices stopped increasing, those were the ones that started falling right away.
Michael, was something unique about the Valley market that really made it more susceptible? I mean, we've seen, all of us who've lived in the Valley for 30-plus years, we've seen the ups and downs,
right.
but it seemed like it was more susceptible. Was there something built in here, or was it just that there was more speculation available?
I think more speculation available. It's been kind of sitting here like, you know, a sleeping dog, and all of a sudden it wakes up, and everybody's making money, and people are coming in on buses to buy. So I think it was just happened to be the right place, the right time, coupled with all these real estate products. But, I mean, everybody's, we went back earlier in the show, everybody was in the business. I was at the airport getting my boots shined. When the guy's done, I pay him $5, and he hands me a card. Hey, if you want to buy a house, give me a call. I'm lending money. And Valley, everybody was in the business. Everybody was a realtor. And it was just that euphoria that was going on that no one thought, is this ever going to stop with it? And then again, people, as far as the contracts, the mortgages. In the old days, with your parents and grandparents, if you sign a mortgage, there's an obligation there, and you're doggone going to make it. Today, no, it's just a piece of paper, you ink it, and that was kind of the mentality. People didn't even look at the documents they were signing. So there was a lack of integrity and moral, I think, in the industry.
So Steve, I was like a pioneer on the internet. So I was getting a lot of leads from California. And for me, it was the investors from California had a big impact. And that's why we saw it where you wouldn't see it as you went further east, for example. Because I would get the internet made it easier. It used to be you would have to make a few trips to Phoenix before you invested. Now you could study it all online. They would come off work, drive to Phoenix. I'd show on some homes on Saturday. They'd have a contract out by Sunday. And they were tended to be young guys, maybe, well, young, in their 30s. They had met somebody at work or some friend at a party who was making really good money in California. But they said, no, that's too expensive in California now. Mm-hmm. And I used to be in Vegas, so why don't you try Phoenix? So there was a lot of these investors from California or in Vegas that were coming in to Phoenix. And that, from my perspective, was a big part of it. And they had sort of California, maybe ethics on mortgages.
This is where the party was. So everybody come to Phoenix. Yeah. This is where the party's at.
Yeah, Catherine, jump in.
And it ended here. And I was saying it ended here. You know, it started in California, and you would hear these bus rides. And it really started in the new home market. And they were buying in multiple subdivisions in the same community, but the investors were not disclosing that to the home builders. And in some cases, even to show they weren't an investor, they were getting local driver's license. So that drew up our population growth numbers, which created another problem. And, you know, we are a growth state. We're a young, Metro Phoenix is a young area. And, of course, we are going to have this in growth. And we have areas for new communities. And we're very affordable for a big city. And we've had a really great, steady home market with, you know, 5 to 6, 7, 8% increases year over year. So it just seemed like a great place to invest. And yes, and I absolutely agree with this gentleman that, you know, the party started in California, went to Las Vegas, and when the ball dropped, it was here in Metro Phoenix. And I know Florida is featured in the movie, but really Arizona was hit so much harder than so many areas because, as what Mike said, we had so many people in the industry. You know, we lost 250,000 construction jobs, and that doesn't even, you know, take at all the other jobs and the people who are making money in real estate and housing.
I need to keep you all pretty tight. Just about a minute left. John, go ahead.
One thing that played out on the new home market was that you would buy a new home, and then the home builder would increase. There was times where they were increasing them $10,000 a month. So if I just bought a home, my home was $10,000 worth. $10,000 more right away. So they would flip them and resell them. So that's one reason why the new home market was, it's the builders were not innocent on this. They were really jacking up the prices quick.
Michael, I want to get your final thoughts.
Fast forward to today, we have good regulation in place. We have good licensing for loan originators. It seems to be a fairly balanced market. I think if we can keep it like this, we'll have a good, steady housing growth in Phoenix.
Catherine, based on what you're hearing and what you know, last 20 seconds or so?
I agree. Yes, things are looking good. People try to say, oh, home prices are climbing too high. We're in a bubble. No, you'll hear Mike Lawler. He agrees. No, we're steady. And home building in town, we're seeing more infill building, people moving in, more millennials, people who lost jobs, the boomerang buyers are coming back. Yes, we've steady, good growth, solid growth.
This conversation could have gone longer, but thanks to all of you. Catherine Rieger, real estate reporter for AZ Central and the Arizona Republic. Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com and Michael Metz, Vice President of Mortgage Lending for Guaranteed Rate. Thank you all.
That was a blast. Thanks, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about what's wrong with the Phoenix Suns. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Citizens Clean Elections Commission, helping to take the guesswork out of voting. You can pledge to vote informed for the 2016 elections on the issues that matter most to you. Details at facebook.com/AZCleanElections.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. We should see partly cloudy conditions today in the valley. A very slight chance for some more showers today and a high near 60 degrees. A better chance for rain tonight and into tomorrow. We're expecting cloudy conditions, a 90% chance of showers, and a high of 55 tomorrow. In Valley traffic on I-17 northbound, there's a crash on the exit ramp at Peoria. On the surface streets over in Surprise, be advised that Cotton Lane is closed between Peoria and Cactus. That's due to a sinkhole there. Here now from Boston starts at 12 here on KJZZ. North Korea claims to have tested a hydrogen bomb today, but experts doubt the truth of that announcement. Also, presidential candidate Donald Trump is saying Senator Ted Cruz may not be eligible to be president since he was born in Canada, even though his mother was American. A look at the rules on presidential eligibility is coming up at noon on NPR's Here and Now. It's partly sunny and 56 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:39.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Phoenix Suns are in the midst of one of the worst runs in team history. Their best player is out for the season with a knee injury. One of their top players rarely gets on the court for a variety of reasons. And the team recently lost to the Philadelphia 76ers and Los Angeles Lakers, considered the NBA's bottom feeders. And now owner Robert Sarver says some of the problems are caused by a so-called millennial culture.
With me for a few minutes to talk about that is ESPN insider Amin Alhassan, who worked for the Suns in much, much better days. Amin, thanks for fitting us in.
Thanks for having me.
So what did Robert Sarver mean by putting some of the blame on millennial culture?
The unfortunate thing is the full quote starts with him taking the blame, the burden, saying it's on leadership. We haven't done a good job of communicating, building trust. But then he, in the next breath, starts blaming millennial culture. I guess the idea that it's an instant gratification generation and don't really have the resilience to stick it out through tough times and figure things out, which, of course, is incredibly myopic statement. To paint a broad brush over the vast majority of the league, really, when you talk about the players in the league, you know, if you define millennials as people born between 1981 and 1996, that is pretty much every NBA player not named Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett.
Yeah, and I wonder, you talk about you worked for the Suns, and you worked for the Suns, like I said, in much better times. Is this about, I mean, they had the same, in the post-Jerry Colangelo era, Robert Sarver was there for a few of the good seasons. Is this about not making the right choices on court, or is the off-court leadership more to blame for these things?
Yeah, it always starts at the top, and as I said, Robert openly acknowledges this. He has failed basically as a leader at the top, and it all trickles down. And so, first of all, they had a good thing, and they ran a lot of the good people who did the good things out of the organization, and we see them flourishing in other places, whether it's David Griffin, the general manager now of the Cleveland Cavaliers, or Steve Kerr and a host of others in the Golden State. It seems like success seems to leave here and go find it somewhere else. And so, you know, that's on Robert. And then beyond that, the decisions he's made in the meantime, as far as who he's hired, who are the decision makers, and the decisions that they've made, see, it all trickles down, it all rolls in. And so for the last 3 years, you know, you can even say that, you know, they had a good coach, they had a good GM, but there still is a lack of focus and a lack of dedication to a single idea or a culture build. And so when Robert Sarver says millennials don't know how to stick it out, millennials want instant gratification, the most ironic part of that statement is he's describing himself.
Well, I wonder about that, too. You have someone who we just saw in the news that he just bought a soccer team with Steve Nash. Should this, based on what we as fans want to see, should Robert Sarver be as involved as a Jerry Colangelo was? Or are those expectations that this is really more of an investment for him?
As far as the Suns go?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it seems like he's distracted with other things.
Well, I don't – that might be a good thing, right? I don't think – mostly owners – it is a hard thing. When you try to tell a billionaire that they don't know what they're talking about, you're talking to someone who has created an enormous amount of wealth against odds, long odds. And so – there is an automatic belief in them that everyone doubted me, but I know what I'm doing. And so it's hard to get them to understand that this is a business that many of them don't have a strong grasp of what makes success. And that's why the good owners are the ones that hire good people and then get out of their way. Let them do their job. Your job is to give them a number that they can't spend more. And then at the end of the year, hopefully hoist the trophy and take credit for everything. That's your job as an owner. But what we're seeing with a lot of the younger owners, the newer owners, I should say, is that they do want to be involved. They do want to be hands-on. But many of them are not equipped knowledge-wise to be hands-on.
I mean, finally, rumors abound in the world of sports. I don't know that Twitter would survive without it. And now we're hearing that there's someone saying that the Suns might reach out to former coach Mike D'Antoni to come back. Can you ever recreate magic like that? And does that sound like a terrible decision?
I don't know if going back to the well would work. I know Mike D'Antoni obviously has an affinity for this part of the country, and he's a brilliant mind. If you look at a lot of the offenses around the league, they borrowed heavily off of the stuff that he came up with in Phoenix a decade ago. But I think to think that him coming back will fix everything ignores the other parts of the equation that were present, which was a good front office that did a good job of accumulating good talent to fit the system.
ESPN insider Amin Alhassan, who's a former member of management with the Phoenix Suns. Amin, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The legends of the Old West still appeal to tourists visiting Arizona and other areas of the Southwest. But in the world of pop culture, it seems that fewer and fewer books, TV shows, and movies are set in that genre. Valley-based attorney and author Gary Stewart says the Western is still worthy of attention and a great storytelling setting. He's writing a Western series called the Angus series that got started with Ten Shoes Up. Gary Stewart joins me now from New Mexico, where he spent the holidays. Why is the Old West an inspiring setting for your novels?
For my novels, I think it works because I'm trying to get people to think about what it was like to live in that era. Because my own experience tells me that while I didn't live in that area, all the problems and challenges and opportunities that I see every day for myself, I know from reading Westerns, were common problems then. And the solutions were different today because the mechanics are different and the culture is different and the technology is different. But the problems are still the same. So I'm trying to take people back, mostly on horseback, not on foot,
yeah,
to that era and experience what it probably was like to deal with the same problems then.
How important is it for there to be a sense of reality to it? There have been some critics who say that too many Western novels play too much into legends and not enough actually what issues perhaps you're talking about in that sense. So there isn't that relatability to it.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. More than half of today's Westerns are kind of pulp fiction. They don't accurately portray the times or the problems, and they are cliché after cliché after cliché, one page after another. It's always limited to the gunfight or falling off the horse or heading down the trail, herding the cattle. And life did involve much of that because it was an agrarian life in the 1880s in the West. It wasn't yet industrialized the way it is today. But the problems were still the same.
Gary, you mentioned some of the issues that take place in your Westerns that are issues that we would think about today. Not to be too obvious about it, but what are some of those issues you're talking about?
For me, some of them come up just because I'm a lawyer. And because I've been practicing a long time and because I teach law at a really good law school right there in Tempe. The legal problems that challenge people in those days are the exact same legal problems that we have today. Not understanding the law because your culture wasn't such that you had an opportunity to understand it. So in my first book, one of the giant problems is the ethical challenge to a law enforcement officer. In my case, it's a deputy United States Marshal, and he runs into the enormous ethical challenge of arresting somebody for a crime that he discovers the person did not commit. He knows to an absolute certainty that the guy he just arrested did not commit that crime, but he's in the process of taking him to jail. And when he gets him there, he realizes that the sheriff doesn't give a hoot that he's innocent. The judge doesn't care. The jury doesn't care. They're all going to string this guy up, officially, legally, hang him for a crime he didn't commit. So he's stuck with that giant moral dilemma.
Well, let's talk more about your protagonist, Angus, not just what he does for a living, but what's his background? What intrigues you about him? Why do you want to keep writing about him?
I'm discovering Angus in each of the books. I've been writing legal books and nonfiction for a long time. So in 2010, I decided to just try fiction, pure, unadulterated fiction. And I had the great good fortune of having Stephen King's How to Write book on my desk at the time. Stephen King has a theory about writing that works for some people and not for others, but it worked for me. And the theory is that if you're going to write a novel, you cannot know, must not know very much about the novel you're writing. You need to start with a character that you've got in your head, somebody that you can visualize. You need to have a genre, whether it's Western or mystery or thriller or romance. And you need to have a setting. It needs to start somewhere. And you need to understand that before you hit the first key. So I started my first Angus book with putting Angus on a horse that was my horse. I know the horse well, and I know the setting well, but I had no idea who he was. He's a guy on a horse riding down a mountain that I've ridden that horse down that mountain, so I can create the setting just fine, but I do not know where he's going. I force myself not to think about that.
Well, now that you're at book number three, do you like where he's taking you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm constantly surprised and constantly happy. He surprises me in ways that I could not have imagined a page earlier. In book one, on page one, he's riding down a mountainside up in northern New Mexico near Chama. That's all I know about him. And it comes to me as a writer, as I'm seeing the typing show up on the monitor in front of me, I'm trying to visualize what he sees. Well, he sees, first he sees the white smoke of a steam train engine. And then he sees the track, and then he hears the sound of the train. At this point, I don't know whether he's riding down this hill in order to catch the train, or to meet somebody at a stop down there, or to rob the train. Turns out, he robs the train. Much to my surprise. I don't know where that came from, and I never know.
Gary, you've mentioned riding horses and how much you enjoy that, and you've done it for a long time. Have any of your best ideas come from riding on a horse, whether it's your nonfiction or your fiction ideas?
Yes, a lot of them have, in both categories, in both fiction and nonfiction. One of the reasons I started riding horses again, you can sit up there and daydream on a good horse. I ride 5 or 6 times a year, and I use that riding time to think about scenes now. And I used to use it to think about legal problems. I've solved problems for clients on horseback that I would not have solved sitting in my office in Phoenix.
Valley attorney and author Gary Stewart. His latest work of Western fiction is called The Valle Caldera. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Rocky Mountains are universally considered to be a beautiful part of the western U.S., but altitude, weather conditions, and terrain can combine to make them very dangerous as well, especially when we don't take them seriously. In his novel Descent, Tim Johnston sets a thriller in that area of the country, and we read about a family's life being slowly destroyed. Johnston will be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix next Tuesday and joins me now for a few minutes to talk about Descent. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so how did you choose the setting for Descent? It plays obviously a central role in the book.
It does, and the easy answer is I didn't really choose it. It kind of chose me. Circumstances had me up there in the Rocky Mountains as a carpenter in about 2007 or so, working on a house, and I was up there all by myself for what feels now like many, many months, and it was, I'm a Midwesterner, so the mountains are kind of a big, exciting deal to me, and they were constantly sort of fascinating to me, and it was really beautiful and all of that kind of thing. But and I'd gone up not to write, but just to be a carpenter for a while and to make some money, because I wasn't making money as a writer, surprisingly. And it wasn't very long, maybe a few weeks, and I was doing some very dull work, painting the walls, and I began to imagine this family of four who were Midwesterners like me coming out to the Rocky Mountains. And after a while, they became sort of so prevalent that I finally put down the paintbrush and started to write them.
So when you were admiring the beauty of it, did you also realize the danger of the area? When did that hit you? Because, again, that danger also plays a big part in the book.
Yeah, I liked your introduction when you said that, beautiful as they are, they can be very dangerous when people don't take them seriously. And I think that was kind of, the sort of fatal flaw that the Cortlands make. And for me, it was, had I not lived up there as long as I did, I grew up watching movies like Jeremiah Johnson, all these kind of, old films where, there's a lot of trouble and hardship up in the mountains. But these days, you know, as Americans, we think we can go wherever we want, and everything's paved and mapped and safe, and nothing bad can possibly happen to us because it's a national park and all of that. It's a park. What could go wrong? And but living up there and going out on myself, going off by myself, you know, to ride a bike or run or walk some trails, I was constantly kind of reminded of how easily I could get lost in all that wilderness. There's a lot of it that's just not paved, and there's nobody around, and you break an ankle, or you slip off the edge of a cliff or something, and no one's going to find you for a long time, especially when you don't leave messages that you've gone out and done this thing.
Tim, when I read a bit about the plot of Descent, which for folks who don't know includes the disappearance or kidnapping of a teenage girl, I wondered whether it was going to fall into that sort of women in peril genre, which I really try to avoid. But your writing really transcended it. And I wondered, did you always plan to focus on the other parts of her family and how much they were hurting and the grief they were going through?
Well, two things on that. I never really understood that there was a woman, women in peril kind of genre going on. And I think since 2007, it's gained a lot of steam, and not just in books, but in movies. And had I thought about that then, I probably would not have written this novel. Had I been able to foresee a book like, you know, Gone Girl or the Taken series of movies or any of that kind of stuff, I would have thought, how cliche, I can't possibly do that. Fortunately for me, I was too out of touch to know that there was this kind of genre out there. So I just went ahead with it. But to answer the second part of your question, it was not the disappearance itself or the immediate aftermath, the search, you know, the frantic FBI hunt and all this kind of thing that was interesting to me. What was interesting to me was what happens after the newspapers and the headlines have faded and the family has had no resolution and they were left to just deal with this mystery and this tragedy. And so that's one of the reasons the novel sort of jumps ahead to 2 years after she goes disappearing and picks up the various family members where they are now. That was the more interesting aspect to me.
I don't want to focus too much on the grief, but I have to admit that's what really, in addition to your writing, which is obviously excellent, I was really focused on the fact that these people really seemed real. Did there need to be that reality in the grief these folks were feeling so that it came across as what people would really feel as opposed to what people might expect to read in a thriller genre, for example?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, you're asking great questions, and I know they're great questions because I immediately have answers. And the thing about the thriller thing is I never thought I was writing a thriller. You know, all my background is in not to sound pretentious, but is in literary writing. You know, I went to the University of Iowa and got my undergraduate degree there, and then I went to and got my MFA at another school, and the emphasis was always on literary realism. And my feeling was that if I were going to do this thing and experience this thing that I've personally never experienced, for one, I have no kids, and for two, I've never lost one of them in the mountains, I was going to take my time and really try to experience the day-by-day emotions of those people. So that was a very slow, sort of painstaking process for me, but I thought if I'm not going to do that, then I'm not really understanding the characters and the book is going to sound false.
Tim, I just had one final question for you. Could you have written
Sure.
Could you have written a compelling novel about these people without that element of tragedy? Were they interesting enough to you as characters without the plot that drives their behavior? Because I was really struck by how deep they all seem. I mean, these are all complicated people and you know, seemed complicated even before something like this happened to their daughter.
Yeah, they were. I think they were sort of in peril as a family before this incident happened to them. And maybe it was part of that imperilment that, you know, that it influenced this thing to happen. I don't know. Now, that's a question I don't really have an answer to because it was so integral to the story that they have this thing happen to them. I think I could have written about them, and it was interesting to me to write about them going about their daily lives and having their sort of daily struggles. But in the back of my mind was always this, you know, there was always this weight of the missing person and kind of the responsibility they all felt toward that. So I don't know. I'd like to think I could, but I think it would have been, you know, a much more quiet kind of novel, you know.
Tim Johnston is the author of the novel Descent. We've been talking about it. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix next Tuesday to talk about the book and sign copies of it. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any of our conversations about the film The Big Short or about the upcoming legislative session, you can hear those segments online later this afternoon at kjzz.org. And if you're a high-tech person, you can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 noon.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Public Market. Farm fresh foods available in downtown Phoenix Saturday 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. and now Thursday 5 to 9 p.m. for Downtown Sundown, a dining, shopping, entertainment experience. Details at phxpublicmarket.com.